Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Woolsencroft. On today's episode, a Premier League game is postponed for the first time due to fan protests. What does that say about Manchester United and English football as a whole? Has breaking into Old Trafford gone too far or sent an important message? We'll get all the answers shortly. Meanwhile, Chelsea's women put on a show to reach the Champions League final, and we'll talk heartbreak endings all on this week's episode of The Game. To help me through it all, Alison Rudd, Gregor Robertson and Matt Dickinson. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Very well, Hugh. Another quiet weekend in the fun factory.
it was a pretty quiet weekend when it came to the Manchester United versus Liverpool game, which we, of course, previewed at length. So at the moment, Jurgen Klopp's race for the Champions League still intact. He will be delighted. We'll get a chance to discuss that. Well, we don't know when. But it was a remarkable weekend, wasn't it, for the Premier League. The first time in the competition's history, a game postponed due to a fan protest. Many peacefully outside of Old Trafford, of course, against the club's involvement in the European Super League. Many also unhappy, as they have been for many years, I think, with the ownership of the club, the Glazer family, of course. A little bit earlier on, I caught up with the Times Northwest football correspondent, Paul Hurst. I started by asking him to outline exactly the events of the day.
The protest yesterday was split into two parts. One group was at the Lowry Hotel, where the United squad were staying. They were trying to prevent them from leaving the hotel. But the main protest was outside Old Trafford. I'd say at least, you know, a couple of thousand people stood on the forecourt, which is behind the east stand. And they started gathering around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And then I think when it got to just after 2 o'clock, about half two, a couple of hundred managed to get into the stadium. They managed to somehow gain access to a door that was next to the Munich tunnel, went through, ran through the disabled part of the quadrant in the corner, and just ran onto the pitch and had a bit of fun on the pitch. One of them picked up a ball and scored a fantastic goal in front of the east stand, a lovely overhead kick while his friend filmed him. And then they started leaving after about sort of 10-15 minutes. And then the police started moving in once the fans had been evicted from the stadium, and it started to get a little bit ugly then. There were the bottles and cans being thrown at the police as they were pushing the protesters back. They pushed them up some at Busby Way and, you know, kept them up there. And then we all expected the game to start, the players to be allowed to leave the hotel and for the game to start. But the fans kept the players at the hotel. They wouldn't let them leave. So the game got called off around 5:30. So, you know, as far as the protesters were concerned, it was mission accomplished, really, because they wanted to stop the game or at least disrupt it to bring attention to their kind of fight against the Glazers. And so they certainly did that.
There are so many ways of looking at this. I've been speaking to so many people, you know, various clubs, neutrals, but fans of Liverpool, Manchester United as well. Some backing the fans, even the fans that went into the stadium, backing their cause, supporting their actions. Others embarrassed by it, saying, you know, you can never sort of condone what has happened. Even big names, I know we'll reflect on Sky Sports, but Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher were there, and you never really felt the sense that they were sort of totally against the actions. And those are just two big figures. I know, like I say, there are many, many more views, but there are so many ways of looking at it. I just really wondered where you sat.
Well, I think basically that the violence, you know, we don't condone that at all. I mean, two police officers got injured yesterday, one of them with quite a nasty cut to the face. So that's not nice. No one wants to see that. I just think that the fans would argue that that they had spent the last 16 years getting nowhere in their quest to get rid of the Glazers, or at least highlight the issues that are surrounding their ownership. So personally, I don't see anything wrong with what they did yesterday in terms of, you know, getting into the stadium. I think that's a legitimate form of protest. I think they wanted to bring attention to the money that's been draining out of the club, and they did that. You know, the Glazers just haven't been listening to the fans for the last 16 years. And the only time that Joel Glazer has spoken to the fans up until the last couple of weeks was 16 years ago. I mean, what kind of a chairman does that? It's just really kind of poor ownership from them. They just don't seem to have an interest in the club whatsoever. So from the viewpoint of the United fans, I think they've been so annoyed that they've not been listened to for the last 16 years. So they've finally taken matters into their own hands. And the Super League obviously just was the trigger for this. You know, everyone's so angered about United being like leading the charge really into the Super League without any fans consultation. So to be honest, I can understand why they were really angry.
Aside from the Super League though, what are the things that these Manchester United fans would want the Glazers to do differently? I know, look, speaking personally, I think Manchester United need a new stadium. They're meant to be a club at the sort of forefront of world football, and many other clubs have been developing those over the past 20 years, you know, whether that be a totally new stadium or just improvements as well. But on the football side of things, the academy side of things, the infrastructure side of things, what are the Glazers not doing right?
Well, I think they're just taking money out of the club every year. That money could be used to buy a new player, to help the stadium, you know, improve the stadium, help the academy even more. One of the things that really annoys the fans is the fact that, and what they want to see changed now is the fact that there's a two-tier share scheme at the moment, whereby the Glazers have a different class of share, which gives them more voting rights, or gives them voting rights. You can buy shares in Man United but not have the same voting rights as the Glazer siblings, which is, to me, it just doesn't make any sense at all. You know, so it's like they're inviting people to, you know, they're allowing people to be involved in the running, you know, to buy parts of the club, shares in the club, but they don't have any say in what happens, which is just doesn't make sense in my opinion. So that's what the fans want to see. They want to see equal opportunities for, you know, all shareholders rather than a two-tier system. And they want to see independent directors on the board as well, just to give them a bit more of a say in what's going on. They want people who are interested in the football club rather than those that are interested in their dividends and the money that they take out every year.
These pictures would have been beamed all over the world, and the reputation of Manchester United, look, for some enhanced by seeing fan power and exactly how far fans were prepared to take it, but for others it would leave a bad taste in the mouth, particularly as you mentioned, you know, injuries to police officers and just the fear for those in the stadium as well than those in the Lowry Hotel. Do you think this will enhance the cause of Manchester United's fans or work against them? You know, given what you've said, is there any way the Glazers will now sit up and listen?
I don't think the Glazers will listen. I think it's or make any kind of changes, but I don't think that will stop the United fans carrying on protesting. I just think it'll be the first of many. And to be honest, I don't think many of the fans who were there, yes, they do expect any change to happen, just because the Glazers were interested in their money over the club. So I think these kind of protests will continue happening, but whether I don't think they will have any impact. It will be very difficult to persuade the Glazers to sell this, to sell the club, or to find anyone who's willing to spend, you know, how much, you know, £1-3 billion to buy it.
Just on a general point, we've had these conversations a lot over the last few weeks with the European Super League as well, but will English fans get to the point that they almost accept that this is almost the business that they helped build, and maybe we've gone too far down the road? Manchester United have happily spent under previous owners lots of money, broke records for salaries in football. They've enhanced their brand. Even Ed Woodward's been lauded for the way that he's been able to produce money into the club in terms of Manchester United and marketing deals. That is now the industry, isn't it? And you wonder whether not just fans of Manchester United, but fans of all clubs will realise that, unfortunately, as great as the Premier League has been, you know, it's been built off big money.
Yeah, that is one of the unfortunate consequences of the modernisation of football, isn't it? You're right. But, you know, I don't know why that would stop, you know, why fans shouldn't be allowed to kind of protest against it. You know, they have been kind of withdrawn from the clubs and the actual involvement in the clubs for quite some time, the fans. And, you know, football's has become this kind of bubble, really, where the players and the clubs are so kind of far removed from fans. You know, they don't talk to them. You know, they're kind of like left in a bubble. And I'm not talking about a COVID bubble, but, you know, like living in their own kind of world, really, where they don't really have any kind of interaction with fans. And so I just think the fans have almost become kind of secondary, really. Even if you pay your money and you go and watch them, you don't really have a say in the running of the club and the kind of the day-to-day aspects of it. So that will annoy a lot of them. And that's why they've taken this kind of action.
Mm. Do you expect, and I know lots of people have mentioned it recently, but government legislation, new laws that stop owners from having, you know, like you say, even a two-tiered voting system, how that's even allowed, I don't even know, but surely our government now needs to step in and do something.
It certainly wouldn't be beyond a populist politician like Boris Johnson to get involved. And, you know, I was talking to someone who was involved in the discussions with government last week, and he was only acknowledging that is, you know, that's the case, that they only really suspect that Boris Johnson's getting involved in this because it would be a vote winner for him. Do you know what I mean? And it would be a good distraction to what's going on in his life at the moment with all the other scandal, etc. So I think you will see a push from government to get involved in this, to kind of at least push this issue of 50+1 or of the more fans being, you know, ownership of clubs. So yeah, I think you will see the government being keen to be involved in helping to kind of try and change how clubs are run, purely for the fact that it will give them, you know, popularity amongst the people, because, you know, everyone loves football, don't they? It's you know, there's a huge percentage of the population who are interested in it and will have seen those pictures on Sunday and thought, right, yeah, let's you know, that it will have shocked them as well.
I'm as encouraged as I ever have been that Boris Johnson might do something positive. Brilliant. Paul Hurst, thank you so much for joining us on the Game Podcast. Well, thanks to Paul Hurst there, sharing his views on everything that's happening at the moment with Manchester United. Let's go back to Matt Dickinson, Gregor Robertson and Alison Rudd. Matt, how do you judge this day in terms of English football and the history of Manchester United? Was it a shameful day or was it a day of hope?
I think we have to see it in quite a broad context, don't we? I think there are, you know, specific issues. Obviously, the Super League, the timing of the Super League announcement at the end of a pandemic when fans have been locked out is another issue. I think there's the fan frustration. I think there is an eagerness to get out on the streets and make a voice heard. And I think that has to be set against a much broader context of fan impotence. I think that's the big issue here, and obviously one that's going to lead us onto, you know, the government have launched a fan-led review. I think we've reached a point in a cycle that's been building up over a good two or three decades where a section of fans feel like the game has sort of changed and they've become maybe more distanced. And this was a bit of a sort of shout of have listened to us, maybe of defiance to that. And I think, say, so I think it's had some historical context, and I think it's had some very obvious short-term provocations as well.
Gregor, what do you think about what yesterday said about English football and fans' relationship to the game?
Yeah, as I said, in the last couple of weeks, we've reached the end of our road. You know, we hear so much that football is a business. That's the line that's trotted out over and over again. But I just feel like we've come to an end point. And it's like, there was always a kind of unwritten rule, even though, you know, wealthy people buy football clubs and they've had various reasons for doing so, that you don't extract money from the club. And I think that's what's kind of the Super League. There's been so many protests against the Glazers for a long time, obviously, but this was like the last point. It was like, clearly they're in it for profit. We knew that anyway, but this is a path that we're going down, and all these clubs, all these owners are now trying to enrich themselves, because we say that people are in it to make money, but the only way that people really make money from football clubs is by an appreciation in value of the club. So if they run the club well, and the Premier League rights have blown up, you know, the value of just owning a club in the Premier League, the club has appreciated in value. But that's kind of been palatable. Fans say, yeah, okay, you know, they're funding the club, or they're covering some losses. If the club appreciates in value, fair enough, they might make a bit of money in the end. But the Glazers have extracted multi-million pound sums of money in, you know, dividends, interest payments, administration fees, whatever you want to call them. And that is distinctly unpalatable. And I think that's, you know, that's something that's been rumbling away for a long time. And this is just kind of, I think what's happened in the last couple of weeks has just given Manchester United fans, not an excuse, but a kind of a final push to say, we're not having this anymore. And personally, I think that's a good thing.
Alison, what do you think of all of this?
I'm a bit gobsmacked. I don't even know what's really going on here. Are the United fans emboldened by the fact that Super League protests were so successful and feel, oh, actually, if we turn up, we might be able to get a few more points across about our club? But I don't know what those points are. I mean, Gregor, who are these people, Gregor, who are multi-billionaires, who are prepared to be pure, be local, and put money into a club and never take anything out again? They don't exist. It's just fantasy world that you think you're going to have a huge club like Manchester United owned by, what, a local businessman who's vetted by the fans and doesn't want to make any money out of it?
No,
I think a lot of it is anti-American. A lot of it is anti-American. Fans don't like the distance. They don't think the people who own the club understand the culture of the club or care about the fans and so on.
They clearly don't.
If those things are important to you, okay, do you remember not so very long ago, This was astonishing, and it's the sort of flip side of this. The Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia were going to take over Newcastle United. Amnesty International came out and said, whoa, wait a minute, please, Newcastle fans, do not let this happen. Do you not realise this is sports washing? And there were an awful lot of Newcastle fans who wrote very eloquently and passionately saying, hey, the rest of you in the media and fans of other clubs, stop criticising the human rights record of a very rich owner. We deserve the right, Newcastle fans deserve the right to have a very generous, rich owner so we can see where we can go. That actually happened. And they're anti-Ashley. Why are they anti-Ashley? They're anti-Ashley mainly because he doesn't seem to have a connection, even though he's British, he doesn't seem to have a connection with the club, and he doesn't want to pump money into it and look passionate every game. But he didn't sanction the murder of a journalist. So you have a group of fans there who would prefer the amoral approach, because it's the rich approach. But the game's gone bonkers. Everyone has a different moral compass on what they feel is unacceptable and acceptable. And the fans' objection to the Glazers away from the Super League, so take that out of it. This was a Man United protest. They are resurrecting how angry they were with their green and gold scarves at the start of the Glazer reign. And that was about fear over their financial modelling and the fact they were overseas and they had a franchise model and they treated sport purely as a business and not as a passion. But they haven't gone into liquidation. They've never been close to going out of business, and they've bought lots and lots and lots of expensive players who are paid lots and lots of money.
First thing I'd say to that is, yeah, clearly we're in a mental place where football supporters' morals are such that they would rather see a foreign state own their football club than a capitalist who's going to enrich themselves. I think that is where we are. It seems that owning a football club purely for profit is the worst thing that anyone can do. That's because it seems fundamentally opposed to how football originated. I know we've come a long way since that point, but all I'm saying is we've come to a point where it's too much. And actually, as you're right, Alison, we're in a weird place when Saudi Arabia buying Newcastle is okay, but say Mike Ashley was enriching himself. I don't think he is enriching himself. He will do when he sells the club. He's not extracting money every year from the club, but they see that as worse. I understand that's crazy, but this is the world we're living in right now. And I think the Super League and what that was proposing, which was further enrichment, greater enrichment of these individuals who own the football clubs, I think we've come to a point where we're saying no one wants that to be the case. We don't want to see that happen. So I think now we've got to discuss how we can prevent that from happening.
I take your point, Greg. I mean, it's obviously on the table in a way that it's never been on the table, but I'm also been fascinated by it. What is the perfect world out there? I mean, this is obviously some of the protesters high profile pictures in the papers today have there are literally 50 plus one on a banner that's been held up. And of course, that's allusion to the German model. And of course, do people really want German football? Well, maybe some do, but there's a reason why the Premier League is the most successful league in the world, is because it's had outside investment buying some of the world's biggest stars. It's not had Bayern Munich winning the title every year for a decade. There is a reason why, the Premier League is, I'm not saying the Glazers are for that, but certainly, billionaires coming in from all different parts of the world, that sort of free market style has been one cause of the success of the league. The big difficulty is we've gone a long way down this road, and it's going to be very, very hard to, I think the nearest have come to it. We did a piece in the Times, whatever it was, a couple of weeks ago, whether you can put in financial regulations that effectively mean that football gets the right type of owners is Graham Lasseau was talking about that, we did in our piece, whether you can put some kind of regulation in that basically means that, you have people who are coming in who are not, well, either able or looking or squeeze the business dry, but these are huge, these are huge difficulties that are going to require legislation. And does the government really want to get bogged down in that? I'm still to be convinced.
When you're talking about Manchester United, a club who have several hundred million pound turnover, and they're still somehow managed to be, I think, £450 million in debt. I don't think football clubs should be able to get into that much debt.
And what about if it's debt to the, debt to a benefactor owner? Is that allowed?
Because then if the club is, and then that's why you have to have regulations that have to at least some degree, the football club is living within its means. Like it's been blown up out of all proportion. That's just all too big now. I think everyone's accepting that. There's too much money in the game, and with so much money in the game and still debt and, clubs imperiled further down and upward drag of resources and pressure on the pyramid, everything. It's all just become too much now. And that's what this is, the Super League has kind of awoken people to that, I think. Because the other amazing thing is that we need to recognise is that the people protesting are the supporters of the Big Six. It's not the rest. And they're all actually calling for more redistribution of wealth. As I said, the Liverpool supporters groups, Manchester United supporters groups, Gary Neville saying that Liverpool, Manchester United should be, as two of the biggest clubs in the country, shouldn't be trying to put themselves in a gilded cage and to the detriment of everyone else. There still has to be some semblance of community in football.
Gregor, for every fan that you'll find will say, I want more money sharing, will be the same. Either you'll find another fan or potentially the same fan the next week saying, well, haven't you signed Haaland for 150 million? City have just signed him. So I do think we have to, we have to remember, as Alison made that point, there is a massive self-interest among fans. There's a fickleness among fans. There's a double standards among fans. And I'm not saying about them. I'm saying us. We're all part of it.
There's a disenfranchisement going on, though. I think a lot of those people who were at Old Trafford are just fed up of I think part of the reason they felt they had to do something radical was that they have no other means of objection. If those fans said, right, well, when football comes back to the fans, we're not going to renew our season ticket, or they said, we're not going to buy a new shirt from the club shop, it would make no difference at all. Their clubs have grown out of them. So you can rip up your season ticket if you're a fan of a big club and nobody bats an eyelid. It's a huge thing to do if you're a smaller club. If you do it in front of the director's box, there's a connection there. But the fans of the big clubs, they know they can dump their club. They can say, right, I'm not supporting you anymore. And it makes not one iota of difference because their club has outgrown them. They've become, as you said, Robert, they're global. And for every local fan who doesn't want to be part of it anymore, there are 500 who would take their place, probably more than 500 actually, and spend more. So it felt to me watching it, it felt like they were really saying, look at me, I live here. This is my club and I don't understand it anymore. I don't know it anymore and they don't need me. What can I do to make them notice me? Because I'm a real fan. I think that was partly what was at the heart of it.
So let's not just dismiss that as kind of naivety.
I'm not dismissing it. I'm saying I think that was.
Well, we're all saying, oh, this is football's become a big business now. That's the world we live in. No, this is the point. We've come to a point where we're saying this has gone too far. The conversation has to be about what happens next. It has to be about tighter regulations, government intervention, because football can't govern itself. It's been repeatedly proved. So that's what we saw 2 weeks ago. If you leave football to govern itself, that's the natural endpoint. And you see other clubs dying while they're trying to keep up. The conversation now has to be what happens to better regulate football and make it safer and make it so that it can't be just all about profit, essentially.
Yeah, Manchester United's owners would say, yes, we've bought the club with a leverage debt. And yes, we pay a big amount of interest from what is made from the club every single year. Knowing full well that they can say to the government with the full intention that when the club is sold, that debt gets paid off and we leave it in a position that it's not in debt, or the new owner, maybe we increase the price by the amount of debt and the new owner covers it. We don't know. But it's so difficult for a government to say to a football club, you've got to go into a position that other businesses don't have to because you've got fans, basically. And, you know, Tesco's doesn't have fans, or you know, Citigroup doesn't have fans, you know, banks don't have fans, but you do, and your business is therefore different in some way. And also, how do you do it once it's already there? You know, do you say Manchester United, yeah, okay, you've got leverage debt, you already have it, but going forward, other clubs can't have it. Do you see what I mean? And then other owners in the future might say, well, hold on a minute, they've got it. It's a really difficult position to be in because you can't then say, do you know what, Glazers, you have to just wipe out your debt, you know, stop, there's no need for the leverage debt, just pay it off within the next 24 months. You get to a point where you're debt free, and everyone else, you've got to get to a point where you're debt free as soon as humanly possible, and then we'll have a total reset. What can you do, Gregor? Honestly, what can you do?
These are big questions. I know.
The two things I've just outlined are basically impossible. I mean, for those people that know anything about business, I've just probably outlined, I've basically described a unicorn, you know, in distinct detail. It's impossible.
Yeah. I would say one thing we could do is improve transparency, first and foremost. And also, yeah, once people are already owners, it's difficult to deal with the way that they're managing football clubs. But there has to be something about a licensing system or something that allows further evaluation of how a football club is being managed. And I know these are businesses and it's not just about how they're being managed on the field, but there has to be something.
What happens if you lose your license?
Perhaps. I know this might contravene business law, but perhaps you're given 3 years to sell up. Like, I know these are crazy ideas and like probably not enforceable in law, but these are the kind of things we have to be exploring. As Alison says, the fans are so helpless. Like, people are so helpless. Like, there's nothing you can do. They've protested for 15 years and the Glazers don't even turn up at a game and they still withdraw millions and millions of pounds every year in dividends. Like, it can't be allowed to... there's nothing we can do to stop them now, really, but there must be things we can do to stop this happening again. And particularly to stop the way that they bought the club.
Yeah, and do you know what? As a Manchester United fan, you know, the moment they bought the club with that leverage debt just seemed insane to me. They basically said, we'll buy the club with this debt and don't worry, Manchester United is so popular that they'll pay for it. which I found to be in how English football allowed an ownership group to do that is madness. It meant that you or I could have found a consortium of people with some money and said, borrowed the money and just said, don't worry, Man United turn over so much money every year that they'll pay this debt off. We don't have to put anything in and we can take over one of the biggest clubs in the world. You know, it seemed to be underscored by the fact that the Glazers were billionaires, basically, in terms of the amount of money they were putting in. It didn't seem to be much at all. But look, again, that's business, isn't it?
Hugh, how, you just said, as a Manchester United fan, so how emotionally did you respond to the scenes on Sunday?
There were some pictures that were embarrassing and sad. Obviously, you don't want to see fans of your football club fighting with police, who are probably local, many of them Manchester United fans, likely, trying to protect a stadium that's empty and being attacked. And obviously, as a journalist, you know, seeing fans of your club throwing missiles at journalists in the ground who have absolutely nothing to do with how the club's run. Once again, you know, that was really sad. I was proud of the people outside the stadium, you know, many, many, many more of them than went inside the stadium who were there protesting in a very peaceful way. And look, the people that got into the stadium and the ones who didn't hurt anyone by doing so, which you can say whether smashing doors down is hurting anyone or not. But for me, it was one of those things where it was like, it's great to see them protesting in this way. I'm a supporter of protest and using their voice, being out on the pitch, even having the game postponed, which I actually thought would do more to get their attention than if they'd have done that and the game had gone ahead. But knowing in the back of my mind that the Glazers are not going to respond to it was the saddest thing. I looked at him when it's almost like felt resistance is futile. And it felt a bit like, again, we've spoken about it so many times, but it felt like clinging on to football of the past. You know, it's like there was a point long, long ago where many football clubs, not just Manchester United, gave up that sense of community for the sake of star players. And we spoke about it with the Super League. You know, the Premier League is built off this huge investment from other countries, and build it and they will come. You know, more and more fans have come, more and more money has come, TV rights have gone through the roof, and it never seemed to end. And for me, it's a different sport. Obviously, being a franchise sport would have changed, you know, the fabric of the sport as a whole. And I can understand why fans were so unhappy about that. But when you look at where the Glazers are as owners, they're at the really unsavory end of ownership groups. But in terms of business, you know, if you were to sit down with ministers and they outlined what the Glazers have done with Manchester United, from a business perspective, they're barely going to raise an eyebrow. You know,
the Glazers did not sanction the state killing of a journalist. The Glazers do not go around saying, we want to live in a state where you can't be homosexual. I mean, for goodness sake, it's ridiculous.
That's why it's going to be fascinating what this review comes back with. Well, fascinating, maybe overstating it. I mean, I say that with respect to Tracy Crouch, who's heading it, who's a former sports minister. And I think, you know, one of the most, that's a sensible appointment to put her in charge. But I'd be interested what you guys think. I mean, my fear is that it'll come back with some sort of fan representation views, which are a sort of nod to the fan voice, but it's going to struggle to do anything much more drastically radical than that. I wait to be surprised. And I think given the light that process is ongoing, now is the time to protest. Now is the time to shout. Now is the time not to throw bottles at policemen, but to make your voice heard. But yeah, does anyone have any greater expectations other than, you know, we think a fan should be on a board, or we think a fan voice should be heard? Maybe a regulator, but is that regulator going to be given a big stick?
The fan's voice is always just going to be advisory anyway. Let's be honest, you know, you could put the fans there sharing their view on every small decision that the clubs make. And the club will do something different and say, we took your concerns on board, but we felt this was the right decision in the end. And look, for some people, that might be a massive step forward. I just don't see how you stop the juggernaut now. It's just, it's impossible. I feel bad for fans of Manchester United for feeling, as I said to Paul Hurst earlier on, helpless, because I think it is that sort of feeling now for loads of football fans. I personally wouldn't want to see that happen all the time at football clubs up and down the country either. I think the most sensible thing to do is for the competition really to change its rules and its guidelines and have strict controls over spending. and do that on a, as I've said before, I think a 3-year period. And that is just, and I know people say, well, it's not competitive, but I think you just got to look at a club by club basis now and say, your club brings finances in at level A, and it is therefore able to spend over a 3-year period this much money. Your club is at level B, C, D, all the way down. And I know what that means.
Isn't that financial fair play?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, we certainly need a form of financial fair play, but we also need the inability to take huge amounts of money out of clubs as well. So I think that has to be part of the structure too.
Where or you say, load them with debt.
Yeah, or load them with debt. Exactly.
Or where you sell say, the stadium. Or, you all know, this is happening in the championship. All these things that are imperiling, yeah, basically the future of these clubs.
I would just wonder what proportion of the fans who protested at Old Trafford would feel if the Premier League actually said to the breakaway six, we are docking X number of points. I mean, a significant number of points. Or they did something very radical to really punish them and then drew up very clear guidelines on what would happen if they repeated their attempts to break away. Would they feel they'd won? Would they feel, great, we're not going to win the title next year because we've been docked so many points, but we've won because we've really rubbed the noses of the owners in it? Or is it just too emotionally confused for them to realise that if you get what you want, your club is not going to be a big club for a bit?
The punishment is that's not the question, so to speak, is it? I mean, the question, as Gregor frames it, I think rightly, is that where is the game headed? Not about, I mean, you know, I can see the case for punishing those six clubs, but this is more about the forces that are driving the game in a certain direction.
There wouldn't have been this protest if it hadn't been for the Super League protest being successful.
But I don't mean,
they are intrinsically connected.
Docking Man United 20 points doesn't make, it gives the Glazers a, you know, headache for the next year because it gives them a bit less money for the next year, but it doesn't change their model, or it doesn't change the direction of where they want to take the club or the game.
It might be the only legitimate way of encouraging them to leave.
I think that comes down to a balance sheet, doesn't it? It's broader football regulation, which to say is the fascination of this whole review about whether, you know, particularly a conservative administration is willing to, you know, come at something that's been run as a free market business and start putting massive regulation around it and legislation around it. And those are fascinating big questions.
I mean, it might be as simple as you can't take dividends out of a football club if
absolutely.
It's in debt.
Yeah.
So the owners can't take any money home when the club still owes.
And the other thing that really it needs to look at is the power is not in their hands. So they, as we said, we've seen that they have controlled the direction of the game for a number of years now, and the threat of the Super League was basically fueling that. That's gone. So now what we need to make sure is that the power is evenly distributed, or in fact given to an independent body out with the game. So, you know, as I said again, the game is not capable of governing itself. Certainly it's proven that for many, many years now. So I think an independent regulator is probably the most important thing that can come out of the review.
No puns intended. We, of course, here on the Game Podcast have been able to govern ourselves quite nicely for a number of years. Gregor Robertson, Alison Rudd and Matt Dickinson, plenty more to come from those three. We'll discuss Chelsea's women in the Champions League as well into the final. Fantastic. That's up next. We'll talk about heartbreak endings. We'll explain that in the end, and we'll look ahead to the men's Champions League semi-finals as well. Stay with us on the game. And remember, if you're enjoying it, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcast from. Make sure you're subscribed to the Times and the Sunday Times as well. You can get it across all of your devices, and if you sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. Just go online right now and search thetimes.co.uk/thegame.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Game podcast from The Times, where we can celebrate a little bit because we've already got one English side into a Champions League final as Chelsea's women put in a stunning display to beat Bayern Munich 4-1 in their second leg and go through to a final against Barcelona 5-3 on aggregate. I'm joined by The Times football writer Molly Hudson. Molly, firstly, how are you doing? And secondly, what a game.
To be honest, Hugh, I think I've just about recovered from it. It was absolute chaos. A brilliant game, a brilliant display of women's football, a fantastic showcase for a Champions League semi-final. And I think it's just the absolute drama of it with the same as in men's football, often away goals provide. It was just absolute chaos, but brilliant, and really couldn't be happier for Emma Hayes and for Chelsea. The kind of feels like this is the product of work they've put in. I think she said yesterday she was sat in Stamford Bridge in 2012 with Bruce Buck and was watching a women's Champions League final that was held there, and said to him, this is what we want to get to, this is what we want to achieve, and now they've finally done it.
Yeah, we'll come to Emma Hayes and her good work in a few moments' time. But just on the specific game, I mean, in the first leg, Bayern Munich, of course, won. Chelsea looked, well, they didn't look themselves. And yesterday it was totally different. What changed?
Yeah, I think Bayern Munich almost played into Chelsea's hands a little bit. And they set up in the first leg, surprisingly, in a 3-5-2. Everyone expected them to line up in a back four, as they normally do. And the wing-backs, Hannah Glass, had a hand in both goals in that first leg, was excellent. They stopped Chelsea counter-attacking, which is one of their main threats. Fran Kirby and Sam Kerr were nullified. And then when we saw them line up in a back four yesterday, just as the game was about to kick off, it was almost like, why have you changed this system? You know, if it isn't broken, don't fix it. And it played out that way. There was just so much space. And I think, as Emma Hayes said after the game, if you give us that space to counter-attack, then we will. And we saw two goals that came from Frank Kirby, and both of which were on the counter-attack. And if you watch Chelsea in the Women's Super League week in and week out, you'll see they will do that to any team if you give them that space.
They rode their luck at times as well, which made for a really dramatic game. But you're right, Pernille Harder, Frank Kirby, Sam Kerr, they were sensational. The advert for women's football, for those that missed it. I mean, it, once again, I think for those who aren't fans of women's football, you sometimes ask why, because it was fantastic, and some of the best players in the world at the top of their game as well. Emma Hayes, as you say, deserves credit, their manager. She's got such charisma, such character in the game as well. Such a great coaching mind, and her emotions afterwards, you know, you're right, you've mentioned it already. It felt like this was the fruition of so many years' hard work. Just describe to us the impact she's had on Chelsea after her years in charge.
She's just been incredible. And I think if you speak to anybody in and around the club, they'll tell you that she's not just the manager for on the pitch. She's like a mother figure to the players off it. She's the driving force in the boardroom, the way Chelsea have led the way in terms of pushing for more professionalism in the league. One of the first teams to really invest in the women's game, to put the money in. You talked there about Pernille Harder. Obviously, she came in for world record transfer fee last summer. So it shows that this is the fruition of all those efforts, I think. And we were speaking to Emma when she came into a press conference, glass of champagne in her hand. You know, she's very, very emotional. And she was talking about the fact that this is what she'd played out ever since she was a young girl, 9 years old. Koenig Street, imagining she was playing in a Champions League final, and now she's there about to lead her team out in one. And it's just an incredible achievement for her. And some of the pictures, you can really see the emotion and just how much it meant to her and the squad as a whole.
fantastic performance from them. But looking ahead to that final, it's up against Barcelona. Emma Hayes talking about how she feels it will be a tricky game. But she also spoke about a conversation she had with Bruce Buck last year, the Chelsea chairman. And she said, I think the Champions League final next year will be Chelsea against Barcelona. So she's not only a great coach, but she's psychic as well, by the way. But looking ahead to that game, how do you predict it will go?
I think she's right in the fact that it was quite predictable that eventually a Spanish team would come good. I think both Barcelona and Atletico Madrid have kind of been there or thereabouts, but they've never quite, you know, got to the final. Obviously, Atletico Madrid have done previously and they've not done too well when they got there. So I think there's been a huge improvement in Spanish women's football. The strength in depth and the national team are seeing that as well. And I think Barcelona will be a really tough opponent. I think the positive for Chelsea is that both Lyon and Wolfsburg, who have such vast experience in the Champions League, are already out. So in terms of winning it, both Barcelona and Chelsea have never done that before. So that's a positive that both of them kind of come into it off the back of that. I think for Chelsea, Magda Eriksson, their captain, came back from injury yesterday. It was such a huge, huge change to that team. She just brings this calm, this leadership. And for me, that was one of the main differences between the first and the second legs against Bayern Munich. And if she stays fit, I think it would be easy to say that Chelsea could win, particularly over one leg. We've seen one game rather than the two-legged format. We've seen just how clinical and dangerous that attacking front three of Chelsea is. You'd always back them to score. Any team in the world, you'd back Chelsea to score against them. So I think it should be a really exciting game. And I think both teams are quite attacking, and it should be another sort of chaotic game, maybe that a little bit of what we saw yesterday.
Our thanks to Molly Hudson for giving us the download on Emma Hayes and Chelsea. Fantastic performance by them on the day, but also I think it's just been growing, as Molly pointed out, for some years under Emma Hayes, who is one of the most intriguing characters in the game as well. But Alison, just the performance in the game and the performance over recent years as Chelsea have grown and grown under Emma Hayes has been something to behold.
Yeah, it's a bit like, I don't know, maybe I can't speak for everybody, but when I watch Chelsea women, it's a bit like what I imagine watching England must be for an England fan of the men's team. I feel they represent me. They are England. I know there are lots of great female clubs, but I just think Chelsea are it. They're the one I've sort of watched grow and grow and grow. Emma Hayes is the most captivating of managers. She managed to mouth an expletive on telly, but without actually saying it, but everyone knew what she'd said. She'd done enough, pushed the boundaries. She's just incredibly good company. You know, if you had a fantasy manager dinner party, you'd invite her along. She'd really shake it up. I admire her enormously. And I watched the game, and I'm not joking, it had everything. I cried, but then I tend to cry when I watch women's football because I think, oh, if only women's football had been as advanced when I was younger, that could have been me. I could have been on telly scoring goals. Anyway, that's my problem. But I do, I get very emotional. But the game had absolutely everything. Honestly, it really did. It had beautiful football, expansive football. It also had some amazing goals, really beautifully taken goals, and the sort of goals you score once in a lifetime goals. And they're doing that at the semi-final of Champions League level. They also had comedy, because the Bayern keeper went up, as keepers do when you've got a minute left and you need to score the goal that will take you through. But she didn't run back. And she sort of loitered around the centre circle thinking, I don't know what to do now. I mean, I've never seen that before. So that made me laugh. And I was just very pleased for, you know, Chelsea have money. They've you know, going back to money again, they've made the biggest signings. They've spent their way to the top, you could argue, but they've also grown organically and each season, and they've stuck with a manager and have got gradually better and better and better and have an identity. And I do wish them well in the final against Barcelona.
Important, though, for women's football in England to capitalise on the big names that have come in recently, Matt. And the attention, you know, lots of eyes, lots of media companies investing in the game as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as Alison says, there is no better advocate, full stop, than Emma Hayes. I will gush about her for as long as we like. I mean, I think she's just, as Alison says, she is brilliant company. She straddles perfectly this sort of, you know, can talk about the game and the development of players and technically, but she is brilliantly emotional, not in a sort of uncontrolled way, but just she shows you who she is. She's not afraid to do that. She's not afraid to be herself. When she's talking to you, you know, you have the most natural conversations with her. I mean, this, you sort of speak to her and just wish every manager in the game was like that. And just the honesty of approach. And, you know, there is not a better advocate for it. So I think obviously there's going to be huge attention around it. You know, history can be made and she will feel like she's not just doing it for Chelsea or for herself, but for the women's game. I think that's another thing that she feels like that she is representative of, you know, her entire sport, and she carries that burden incredibly well.
The goals, Gregor, ridiculous.
I love watching Fran Kirby play as well. She's so kind of nimble footed, but tenacious as well. And the Bayern goal, crikey, the absolute screamer. So yeah, brilliant drama. And some of the kind of, you know, last few minutes, the blocks on the line and kind of clearances and, you know, throwing your body in where it hurts. It was just great drama. So but Fran Kirby was a star.
Check the highlights out if you haven't seen it. You'll see firstly a cracking goal from Bayern, but of course an English team beating a German team in the Champions League semi-final always goes down well as well, doesn't it? Look, Gregor, let's stick with you for the moment, because this weekend you did see real drama elsewhere as well. Lincoln giving away a 3-0 lead against Peterborough. It saw the Posh promoted to the Championship. It also saw Lincoln's automatic promotion chances ended, if I'm correct. Yes. So we thought we'd discuss sort of heartbreaking endings, because it was a 96th minute penalty, was it?
96th minute, yeah. So Lincoln were the only team who could catch Peterborough, and Peterborough had two games to go, but Lincoln had a game in hand in midweek too, so it could have gone down to the final day with a Lincoln win. And as you say, they were 3-0 up as late as the 65th minute, and then the comeback began. If Tom was on this podcast, he would be I don't know, he'd probably be in tears, because it was probably the worst refereeing decision I've ever seen in my life to award a penalty to Peterborough. Sammy Smodic's got the ball. It's like a final last hopeful ball forward. They'd hit the crossbar. They'd had a header just an inch wide of the post. Brilliant drama. A final ball forward fell to Smodic's, and he did a kind of little pirouette over the ball. And the Lincoln player literally jumped out of the way because he knew, you could see he was trying to buy a penalty, and the ref pointed to the spot. And Johnson Clark-Harris scored his 31st goal of the season to give them the winner. And as you can imagine, the scenes were incredible, because they could have gone up on Tuesday night and the supporters all turned up outside the stadium, let off fireworks when they were 2-0 up prematurely, as it turned out. And Doncaster came back and drew 2-2. And so they all gathered again. And you can imagine what they were thinking. There was a downpour before the game, so they're all drenched in their Stone Island gear. And then 3-0 down after an hour. And then that at the end, it just made me think, you know, I'm not sure there's any better drama than the kind of end of season race for promotion. And, you know, relegation battles as well in the Football League, because there's so much on it, so much riding on it. You know, we'll talk about cup finals and those moments of great drama, but it literally shapes the future, promotion or relegation. So there's something extra on it. And every single year, the Football League throws up these end of season final day kind of, or final couple of days, remarkable games of loaded with drama. And this was one of them. Come back for the ages. Brilliant.
And so we thought we'd ask about heartbreaking endings elsewhere as well, and our memories of them. Alison, I'll start with you. Heartbreaking endings?
Well, first of all, I think we're partly talking about endings because Line of Duty's endings was so rubbish. So the best bit of telly on Sunday was not Line of Duty. It was, I don't know if you all spotted it, when Gary Neville was stood in front of the pitch at Old Trafford, reeling off why the fans had every right to do what they were doing. And David Jones, the anchor, tried to interrupt him with, surely, Gary, you don't condone. And Gary replied, this is not the time to interrupt. And I just thought, oh my goodness, how ironic. The man who likes to interrupt and believes in interrupting people to make sure they don't go down a rabbit hole. I thought that was quite interesting. But in terms of classical heartbreak endings, there's none more memorable, because the one that immediately came to my head was the 1998 playoff final. It's the Sunderland 4, Charlton 4-1. because Clive Mendonca's from Sunderland and he scores a hat trick against his club, if you like. And then Michael Gray, who's also from Sunderland, steps up to take the penalty and he can't, he's so nervous and aware of the moment. He can barely hit the ball. That emotion and pressure means it sort of trickles towards the goalkeeper and then Sunderland lose. I mean, and I remember watching that and sort of not crying, but wailing with sort of empathy of agony. That was very sad. And just because I'm predictable, I would like to give a mention that heartbreaking was the way Iceland went out at Euro 2016, because I'd predicted months before it started that they would win it and everyone had laughed at me. And then they knocked out England and I got loads of apologies. And all they did was have a little bit of hubris against France, who very cleverly allowed them to play a bit of football. But I found that quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, icebreaker as well, if you like.
It was funny, Alison mentions 1998 playoff final because I was there covering it, and it was it's funny whenever anyone mentions about, you know, what's the most dramatic stuff you've seen, it's always the one that people I like throwing out, because, you know, it wasn't 99 at the Nou Camp, but it was no less dramatic. It was, you know, 4-4, 7-6 on penalties, as Alison says, the Michael Gray. I still remember it finished and I thought, right, I've now got a lot to write about this. And I walked to the Wembley toilet, the old Wembley, and just got a cold tap and doused myself in that cold tap, for just because I wasn't a Charlton fan, wasn't a Sunderland fan, but it was just one of those couple of hours where you were just mesmerized and gripped and you just found yourself engaged in this lurching emotion of it all. It was just a spectacular, and like Gregor says, you know, when relegation and when promotion is hanging on stuff as well, it's changing the shape of more than just one match and one trophy. So yeah, that was up there.
I think mine is the 2014 Champions League final. Atletico Madrid against Real Madrid. Of course, they're city rivals who they've lived in the shadow of for so, so long. The reason it's heartbreaking, if you don't remember, Atletico were 1-0 up until the 93rd minute when Sergio Ramos scored a header from a corner. I think because it was Real Madrid, no one really cared about how Atletico Madrid conceded that corner. It was an overhit, last-ditch ball into the box. Two defenders at the back post with no Real Madrid players challenging them. And basically, you thought both of them are just going to leave it to run out. The first one left it, first player left it, and the second player didn't realise. And it bounced off the ground and knocked into his shins as he tried to jump out the way. And he conceded the corner. And just about then, it was like, they were already describing it as the last roll of the dice, you know, throwing the ball forward, all the defenders were up into the box. Sergio Ramos scored the header from that resulting corner. They scored three goals in extra time. And it was actually the first time that a Champions League final, I think, had gone to extra time and actually had a winner during extra time and hadn't gone to penalties. But I think the life was just drained out of Atletico Madrid at that point in time. I was totally gutted for them. And Gabby, in particular, their captain as well, who had been like a club man through and through, devastated. But yeah, another heartbreak ending, of which, of course, in our wonderful sport, there are many. Look, we've just about run out of time, so we'll talk about the Champions League semi-finals, I'm sure, at length on Thursday as well, with Manchester City and Chelsea in action. But Matt Dickinson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson, thank you for being with me for the past hour or so, enlightening as ever. And thank you all for listening as well. Remember, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from, and make sure you're subscribed to our award-winning journalism from the Times and the Sunday Times as well. If you sign up today, you'll get 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. We will see you on Thursday.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.